Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and a warm welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up a little later with the podcast, stay ahead with stories that really matter. Coming up on the program today, how will government fill the 75 billion rand shortfall after its midnight VAT scrap announcement? Emerging powers split on priorities as new geopolitical blocs take shape. Global trade shifts open fresh investment doors for African capital, and why ordinary Africans are struggling to access their own continental human rights court. It's Thursday, the 24th of April. In a statement delivered at midnight, South Africa's Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana scrapping the planned VAT hike, leaving a 75 billion rand hole in the country's finances. You'll be well aware the decision follows intense political opposition and legal challenges, particularly from coalition partners like the Democratic Alliance. So with the VAT increase off the table, there are questions about how the government is going to address the significant revenue shortfall. Joining me now is Davie Roet, Chief Economist at the Efficient Group. Davie, a very warm welcome. Welcome to you. What's your assessment of the situation? It seems like a complete U-turn.
Jeremy, hi. Yeah, it is apparently 75 billion rand. I say apparently because I'm not so sure the Minister of Finance is actually going to get 75 billion over 3 years. But for 1 year, it's likely to be around 10 billion rand or so. Now, certainly that is a lot of money. But from a bigger point of view, it's really not that much. And the reason why I say so is because in a previous financial year, there was actually an overcollection of approximately 10 billion rand. So if it's about this 0.5% increase in the VAT, It's not really about money in the current financial year. Over time, of course, everything adds up. So that's the first point. It's not really that much money. A second point that is important is that I think what is happening at the moment is that the emphasis shifts to where it should be, and that's on state expenditure. Everybody's trying to find more money, but that's not the issue. That's not the problem. The problem is actually that the state is spending too much money. And something else that I'm very concerned about, and what we all should be talking about actually, and not about this VAT, is that the IMF yesterday adjusted their outlook for economic growth in South Africa downwards to 1%, and I don't think we're going to see 1%. And that's going to have a much bigger impact on the total revenue of the state than this change of 0.5% in value-added tax. So the emphasis, like I've said, should actually be on the expenditure side and not on the revenue side.
Let's talk about that IMF decision in just a moment, but just back to the VAT very quickly. Would government, yeah, what alternatives does government have then to address this revenue gap? As you say, 10 billion a year, not huge, but still sizable. Where does it go to now?
Well, the reality is that if you want to get, say, 10 billion rand extra, actually the Minister of Finance is looking for 13.5 billion rand in the current financial year, which is, and for the next financial year, he wants to increase VAT by another 0.5%. So that we're talking in a broad region of about 30 billion rand extra annually. And the short answer to that is that it's basically not possible to get that additional, say, 30 billion rand annually, or say 13 billion rand in the current financial year. The major taxes that are available are personal income tax, and personal income tax cannot be increased further. In fact, we've had a substantial increase in personal income taxes of nearly 20 billion rand in the current financial year. So, but that is not an option. Of course, you can try to do that, but you're going to do immense damage to the economy. You're going to lose a lot of taxpayers. A lot of people are already leaving the country because of high levels of tax. The other alternative would be to look at company taxes, and that's a no-go as well, because our company tax is currently at 27% roughly. It compares very, very badly with most other countries in the world. Then you've got the rats and mice. You can go for fuel levy, for example. There, perhaps you can get 2 or 3 billion. You can go for some of the other sin taxes, and now the amount's getting smaller and smaller, 1 or 2 billion here and there. So the short answer is that try to get 13 billion, perhaps by increasing some of the smaller taxes, but going for something bigger like 30 billion next year, that is very close to being impossible.
So where does government then start in terms of making a meaningful impact on denting its high expenditure?
There are many places where they can start. I think there are two places, two things that are important. The first one is that you have to have a symbolic cut in certain expenditure. And I say symbolic because it's important to show to the people in South Africa that we are also taking some of the pain. And a very good symbolic cut in expenditure is simply to cut in this expenditure on the blue light brigades and say, listen, we're not going to use it anymore, as an example. But then we have to start with the big expense items. And the big expense items are things like, for example, a lot of things that we spend money on that we shouldn't be spending money on. Of course, we can cut back on the number of the big the cabinet, but that's actually relatively small amounts of money. So we can cut back on that, but that's not going to make a significant dent. But other things, like for example, Department of Small Business Development, we should simply get rid of that. We should start asking questions about should we have a Department of Sport? We should ask questions about shouldn't we privatize a lot of these state-owned enterprises and use that money to pay off state debt, because interest on state debt today is the second most important expense item for the Minister of Finance. And then, very importantly, we have to look at the efficiency of the state. The state is certainly not efficient. And most important, I guess, will be to put measures in place to encourage economic growth. And that in itself will lead to a much bigger revenue to the Minister of Finance to spend on all these things.
And all of that takes political courage, and that seems to be in short supply at the moment.
But certainly, something that I'm very concerned about, and everybody's talking about this, and this is nothing new, is that the remuneration of civil servants is just completely out of line. We cannot keep on increasing the wages of civil, or the salaries of civil servants above the inflation rate. We've just given them another 5.5% increase in salaries. That's just not on. We cannot afford it anymore. And perhaps it's time for politicians to start acting like real leaders and tell people that, listen, we're paying you too much, and we know that you're not going to vote for us again, but we are responsible and we're looking after the well-being of South Africa. We can't only look at certain sections of South Africa and this for the civil servants only. The civil servants get something, and I've done some calculations. The civil servants get close to 20% of GDP. That's how much we pay civil servants in South Africa. It's completely out of line. So we need to cut back on that. Civil servants remuneration is far too high, and we have to improve the efficiency of the state as well.
And just a final one, how seriously are you taking this IMF forecast? The country or the institution's chief economist saying, and I quote, "We're entering a new era as the global economic system that has operated for the past 80 years is being reset." It's not just impacting South Africa. This is a global warning.
Yeah, certainly. I agree with them. I agree with their 1% for South Africa. In fact, I've got slightly less than that. I started off the year at 1.5% for South Africa. AGOA is going to cost us 0.2 or so. Some other tariffs is probably going to cost us another 0.2 or so. The uncertainty in the government of national unity and the budget, the disaster around that, that's also going to cost us some. So I think we should be lucky if we get 1%. But I totally agree. We are living in a new world. There's so much uncertainty. I don't know if there's going to be a new tariff on or off tomorrow morning. And that uncertainty is just not good for anybody.
Davie Roux is the chief economist at the Efficient Group. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As the global south starts to gain more clout, its views on war, on trade, and democracy are starting to diverge. And there's a new study that reveals how countries like South Africa, Brazil, and India are seeing the world currently, and what all of this means for diplomacy. I'm in conversation now with Stephen Groost, who's head of African governance and diplomacy at the South African Institute for International Affairs. Stephen, a very warm welcome. All of this contained in a document called the Emerging Powers Report. What's the most surprising finding in your opinion?
Hi, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. Well, I think one of the things that really stands out in terms of the South African results is that we asked them who actually makes foreign policy. And compared to the other countries, South Africa was much, much higher in saying that the ruling political party makes policy. Last year in the survey, 74% said that. But this year, actually, 62% said that. So it's perhaps a reflection of the government of national unity. But that number is much higher than the other countries, which was only 16% in Brazil, 36% in India, and 48% in Germany, which was the fourth country in the study. Also, how South Africans actually feel that we have improved in the way that we execute foreign policy. up from 47% last year to 73% this year. So perhaps suggesting a stabilization in our foreign policy. But yeah, lots of interesting results to dig into in the report.
Let's go to the first one. What is the risk of a ruling party driving or influencing foreign policy to the extent that the African National Congress does?
Well, as we know, it's been so dominant for the last 30 years, despite the poor results in the elections last year. And I think it can create frictions between the party and the presidency, the party and the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. You get mixed messaging. In South Africa's case, for example, on the Middle East, the party always seems to be more radical than the government. And that line between state and party is often blurred. But the ANC statements take on a much more strident and incisive view of, say, the Israel-Palestine conflict, whereas Durko is slightly more measured. So I think that's the danger, that you have a party that dominates all parts of society, including foreign policy.
And that's interesting, because there's that dichotomy, as you say, between, on the one hand, the ruling party driving an agenda, but perhaps, as you suggest, a more moderate approach as far as international relations and cooperation is concerned in terms of foreign policy implementation. Is that down to a better minister, to perhaps a more cautious and conservative approach, or a combination of that and others?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of that and others. I'm not sure we've had really enough time for Minister Lamola's style and substance to really seek in. In a lot of ways, it's a continuation from Naledi Pandor. Maybe the tone is different. It's slightly less lecturing and castigating, I think, than her. She sometimes was a bit caustic in her remarks. But I think there's a whole mix of things that goes into foreign policy, not least of which what's happening with our partners and allies, what's happening in global geopolitics, and the poor relations with the US at the moment are a case in point.
Do you think South Africa is still non-aligned, or are we just hedging our bets these days?
Well, some would say that's the same thing. but certainly, for example, on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, South Africa claimed to be non-aligned, but seemed to be coming down heavily on the Russian side in terms of its actions and its abstentions at the UN and so forth. But this week we'll be hosting President Zelensky. So there is a more of a balancing between those things. On some issues, there's no budging South Africa, and that's certainly the case with the International Court of Justice case against Israel. No matter what the US is going to say, I don't think South Africa is going to abandon that anytime soon at all. So there's always this mix. I think South Africa is finding its way in foreign policy, dealing with a White House that is so radical and has picked on South Africa. I think will be extremely challenging, especially in this year of hosting G20 and hoping that America doesn't spoil the party.
Given our close relationship with Russia, how difficult is it going to be for this country to navigate that Zelensky visit?
I think we have the diplomatic skill to be able to do that. Obviously, Russia won't be happy about it. It's been a long time in the making. It was first mooted in about September. It was announced in January, and it's eventually coming this week. So Russia has had some time to absorb it. I don't think it's going to damage our standing with Russia, but it is going to even the scales a little bit.
Just in terms of looking forward as far as foreign policy is concerned, we live in this multipolar environment right now. It's a divided world. Isn't foreign policy these days more transactional rather than values-based?
Very much so. Certainly if you are in the White House and Mr. Trump, he definitely has a transactional approach. What do I get for what do I give? What is in it for me? What is in it for America? And I think this is forcing the rest of the world to take note and to work in that mode. However, for a country like South Africa, values remain very important and still guide a lot of our foreign policy choices. Ideology sometimes also guides those choices, even when in practical terms it doesn't make sense or isn't necessarily the best course for the country. So I think, yes, there is a lot. And I think going forward, we are definitely going to see countries having to really define what is in their national interests and how they are going to deal with this complex multipolar world.
And how important then is the upcoming G20 as far as South Africa is concerned and its changing role and changing influence within diplomacy?
It's massively important. South Africa is the last country on the roster of the G20 countries to host it. I think South Africa has taken it very seriously and wants to continue the legacy of the developing countries that have chaired the G20 in the past. It's a high-profile event. There are hundreds of meetings that are happening in the run-up and around the summit. Diplomatically, it's very important for South Africa, and its skills will be put to the test as global relations fray between Europe and the US, as the US appears to be getting closer to Russia. There's going to be a lot of skill needed, for example, to come out with a joint communique that satisfies everybody at the end of that meeting in November. So I think South Africa is working very hard, and make no mistake, we are in the international spotlight for sure.
Stephen Grootz, thank you very much indeed. Head of African Governance and Diplomacy, the South African Institute of International Affairs. And let me give you a quick update on that story. President Zelensky saying just a short time ago that he's now cancelling part of his program in South Africa. He arrived last night and is returning to Ukraine after intense Russian missile and drone attacks on Kyiv. Zelensky saying on the Telegram app that the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha would conduct all necessary meetings in South Africa to inform leaders about the ongoing situation in Ukraine.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there's no doubt the trade winds are starting to shift, and not just metaphorically. As the world fragments, investors are chasing new frontiers from digital trade to green ports. So the question is South Africa, and are we ready to ride this new wave? I'm in conversation now with Johan Manrick, who is head of fixed income private markets at Stanlib. Johan, a very warm welcome to you. So maybe give us the big picture first. What's the biggest shift that you're seeing in global trade patterns right now?
Of course, we are in the midst of a very uncertain time where traditional trading partners are being challenged, where trade is being weaponized. I mean, you hear commentary that talks about potential trade wars. I'd say we probably are already well entrenched within trade wars, where the big trading blocks in the world between the States, Europe and China all have their guns out pointing firmly at one another. There's been tariffs, there's been retaliatory tariffs from both sides of the trade divide. And this leads to a very uncertain global trading environment where greater division, economic divisions and barriers are being put up amongst traditional trading partners. So I'd say this is by far the biggest theme that we're facing. It's disruptive and one that I think leads us to talk about the changing winds of trade.
And within those changing winds, I imagine, Johan, there is opportunity. And let's get to that in just a moment. But are you starting to see companies worldwide reevaluate or even recalibrate their supply chains?
Yeah, Jeremy, obviously supply chains are not easy and quick to change, right? Companies typically, depending on the sector that you play in, need to form relationships. It takes time to put those in place. It takes time to secure the terms of trade, the manner in which you can secure your markets, including supply of goods into your local markets, if that's the game that you're in. And it's not quick and easy to do that. That said, obviously, with costs of old trading partners changing and increasing, it is absolutely the case that businesses that we invest in and talk to locally do reevaluate where they offlay product and also where they source product continually. There are different reasons why they may be doing it. I refer to costs, which obviously tariffs is the big topic of the day, but there could also be other factors. There are many pressure groups around companies that cause them to relook at where they source, making sure that items are sourced ethically and appropriately, and also where they trade. And in addition to tariffs, of course, often there are sanctioned parties in your supply chain, and you want to be careful as a company that you keep your business in the right relationships to make for longer-term sustainable business environment.
So, Johan, in that respect, then, there is new thinking as far as investment is concerned, and principal among that is infrastructure. Why is that top of mind?
Yeah, of course, in South Africa, it's such a big theme because we have a poorly maintained infrastructure, but that is in dire need of intervention and further investment. That said, not only is what we have poorly maintained, but it's also been inadequate, right? We have a huge catch-up to do to get us to compete on the global arena, and this is across different industries and also crossing public and private sector. And that said, obviously, that geographically, the part of the world where we are and with whom we do trade is also very poor from an infrastructure perspective, and opportunities abound at this moment for infrastructure investments across South Africa and the subcontinent. Some of the themes, apart from what I've mentioned already, include obviously the transition from, can I say, non-green ways of generating energy, as an example, or operating within industry to transition to greener and often more efficient technology. So there is a very big capital formation theme that typically speaks to corporate, public, as well as private infrastructure requirements to get us to the right level to be able to compete. Bearing in mind, I just want to emphasize that a shift to green is often a shift to more modern and more efficient technologies to allow you to compete.
And a lot of your argument, I would imagine, is predicated on the success of public-private partnerships. Yet the argument is that we're not seeing enough follow through.
Yeah, that is right. That is right. And we've seen that over the years in South Africa. The private sector is there with funding and investment capacity and capability. What I mean by that is funds are available and the private sector has the ability to assess risk and argue for the appropriate returns or negotiate for the appropriate returns at the back of that risk. But often the public sector, not only here globally, often the public sector is slow to move to meet some of that ability to fund from the private sector. And it's a long-standing lament. And look, I think all we can do is re-emphasize the need for the public sector. These are policymakers and politicians often, but to do what is right and to work proactively to meet some of these large pools of investment capabilities to make a difference in the countries where we operate.
And Johan, just a final one. You're not going to get your nose ahead in this debate unless you're very adept at e-commerce and digital finance solutions. It plays a critical role in modern trade deals. Are we playing that game correctly? Are we adept enough, do you think, in that respect?
Yeah, I think we've got a lot to learn, Jeremy. But firstly, I think to highlight it as the great democratization of trade and the ability for smaller enterprises and big enterprises to enter markets and speak to consumers that they've never done before is all enabled at the back of e-commerce, and well done for calling it out. Where is South Africa in this? Well, I think our companies, our big corporates have a lot to learn. Let me just also say very quickly that our banking financial sector is, of course, very advanced, and I think there's a lot that we can still benefit from continuing to invest in financial services across the board, but also backing some of where banking capital has gone in SA, but in some of our developing markets, but also across the continent. Lots of benefits to gain and great examples there of how to make the most of the opportunity around us.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Johan Manovic, thank you indeed. Head of Fixed Income Private Markets at Stanlib. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa, I don't need to tell you, always talks a big game on human rights, but I read it's still blocking individual access to Africa's top human rights court. So what's the problem here? Is there anything specific that we are concerned about, even afraid about? So let's explore this in a little more detail now. I'm in conversation with Professor Frans Viljoen, Center for Human Rights at the University of Pretoria. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe just explain this to me as a starting point. Why are South Africans unable to take their cases directly to the African Court on Human Rights?
Thank you, Jeremy. Yes, it's a little complicated, but South Africa has accepted what we call the protocol to the African Charter. So the African Charter on Human and People's Rights is the main African Union human rights treaty, and we've accepted that. But under the treaty, there ordinarily is an African Commission, which is not a court, but a kind of a quasi-judicial body like our South African Human Rights Commission. And if you accept the charter, then individuals can take cases to the commission. But later on, a court was added, and that is through a protocol to the African Charter. And South Africa has accepted that protocol, which means that under the protocol, individuals in South Africa can get to the court, but they must first go to the commission, and then the commission can refer the case to the court. And that is a long, arduous journey that very few times have been successful. But in that protocol, there's also a provision that says a state may opt in to a procedure that allows individuals directly from South Africa, having exhausted their local remedies here, that they can go directly to the court. And that direct access to the court, South Africa has not accepted up to now.
So does this raise questions about our constitutional values, Professor, or is it simply something which is procedural and maybe, as you've suggested, time-consuming?
The idea of direct access then is that it is much less time consuming, it's much more immediate. And that's why I think if we have a right of access to judicial remedies and remedies in general under the Constitution, which we do, then our argument, you know, from a human rights point of view, is that South Africa should accept this direct access, because that will give the possibility of effective recourse. You know, we have to accept that even if we think our judicial system is you know, progressive and human rights based, there is always the possibility that there are cracks and there needs to be a complementary. And, you know, most democracies in the world accept the judicial authority of a higher court for these cases exactly. And the argument is that, yeah, our constitutional value related to access to judicial remedies would be best served if South Africa accepts this direct access to the African court as well.
Professor, you talk about the importance of effective recourse. What kind of cases then might individuals bring?
Yeah, they can bring cases that have exhausted local remedies, right? So that would be cases where our courts have, you know, up to the highest court, generally speaking, the Constitutional Court. Yeah, and it is true. You could, one of the arguments is, but in a sense, South Africa has very little to be afraid of, as you suggested at the beginning, right? Why should we not do it? We can just strengthen this African court. We can say that we are subservient as a country to this African court, send the message that, you know, we honor and we also see the relevance of these African Union Pan-African institutions. And one day, if the case comes, you know, we will have to deal with it. There had been cases, for example, brought to the African Commission before against South Africa. But, you know, they were either found to be inadmissible or to have not constituted a violation. So in essence, we are saying there's very little for South Africa to be afraid about, and they should just take a lead, because few states in Africa have actually accepted this direct access. And the fear is that this court will just become like a white elephant if states like South Africa do not at least give it the possibility of, you know, recourse from the state level to the international, the regional level.
And how much pressure right now is coming from civil society?
I think, you know, unfortunately, again, this it's not one of the major issues in civil society. I think, you know, a number of the NGOs that work particularly with the African Commission, we advocate for this to happen. But the argument South Africa usually makes is, you know, put most positively, we have a very, you know, human rights friendly constitutional court. You know, why should we? Why should we? It's kind of a South African exceptionalist argument, a bit like the US in some ways, right? Saying, oh, we don't really need even some kind of supranational court. But the counter argument to that would be, but that may be true now, or perhaps, you know, in particular circumstances, but it's about the state committing itself, for better or for worse, to be within this African regional framework, also subservient when the time comes and the need arises to have that recourse possible.
How much concern is there, Professor, that the court could become politicized, and that is possibly why there is some hesitation?
I'm sure that, you know, if we look at other countries that have made the declaration, you know, there has actually been cases where they withdrew the declaration, like Rwanda made the declaration, they accepted the court's jurisdiction, and then they withdrew it. And they said it was because, you know, someone who was accused of a genocide had brought a case against Rwanda. Now, the problem here is that that was a legitimate case to be brought because the person got an inordinate, you know, long sentence, and there were some fair rights issues. So, you know, the defense of, you know, politicization could always be raised. But I think it's exactly when, you know, vulnerable interests are at stake that you need something that is not just, you know, parochial and domestic, that actually can lift the issue to a broader perspective.
And then just a final question, and very quickly, what in your opinion are the consequences of continued inaction on this issue?
I mean, I think we are sending out a message that we are not fully African. That's essentially, you know, we are members of the African Union. We accept the court's jurisdiction, but only to a certain extent. We're saying that we're better, in a sense, judicially speaking, human rights speaking, than the African continent and its institutions. And rather than sending that message, I think we should send the message that we want to be part of it and improve it and, you know, collectively with other states, strengthen and enhance the African institutions and recourse to the highest court in Africa.
Professor Frans Viljoen is with the Center for Human Rights at the University of Pretoria. Professor, thank you very much. And that is our program for today. We are back tomorrow, live at noon, and then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.